Kirby Monsters is a podcast about facing the unknown.
I start to float away from the earth.
Have you ever smoked crack before?
We're all kind of frantically searching for meaning.
They have the neurotransmitters.
I think we're all juggalos in some way.
Yo, we're not broken.
Crazed delinquents.
We're in our last days, young man.
Listen to Here Be Monsters,
the podcast about the unknown,
on the KCRW iTunes page.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and today I'm happy to be with Dana Spiota. Her new book is called Innocence and Others. That's Innocence, C-E-N-T-S. And they are people who we might not think of as innocent. Most of them feel themselves to be very guilty. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, who are the innocents in this book?
Well,
are they all?
Yeah, I mean, I think that all of the characters are both innocent and other at various times, and certainly start out as innocent and maybe go back to it somehow if they can. Yeah.
Well, the first one that we meet is a woman named Meadow. She has decided, because Orson Welles, she says, has learned to be a filmmaker by watching, she thinks, City Lights 20 times in a row. Mm-hmm. She's going to an arts high school. Mm-hmm. Crossroads is the real version of it here in Santa Monica. And you call it, what is it?
Wake School.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And she watches Citizen Kane 20 times, makes notes on each screening, realizes that Welles could not possibly have watched any film 20 times in a row, that it's not worth that effort. And so she learns immediately that she's modeling her behavior on the behavior of a big liar.
Yeah. Yes.
And she goes on right away to be a big liar.
Right.
We meet her as she's putting out an essay on a blog saying that essentially her life began when she had an affair with Orson Welles. He's not named, but he's unmistakable.
Right, right. And in the blog post, she also lies to her parents, but of course it's a kind of idea of seduction in that he admits that he's telling a story about himself, and in a way that makes his story even more compelling. It's like showing someone how to do the magic trick, and in a way that kind of disarms them, and then you can really do the magic trick. So I think she learns a lot about that idea from Orson Welles.
Except we learn that it's all
not true.
Not true. That what we've been reading has been an intimate secret revelation. We buy into it, but it's not true. Who is she? Now that's the kind of lie that an innocent does tell. She's trying to account for her origins. Mm-hmm. Now she's an older woman. She's looking back on her life. She's been an experimental filmmaker. What better than to say that Orson Welles wound her up and started her off? But it's not true.
Well, except that
it
if
is
you look
true.
At Carrie, what Carrie says about it, her best friend, is that in a way she did have a love affair with Orson Welles because she loved his movies. And for Meadow, that is the ultimate love, is the love that she has for film.
But this is one of those books that is going to explore that peculiar crevice between life and art. It's interstitial, Meadow has moved to upstate New York.
Mm-hmm.
She's met a local outcast
mm-hmm.
named Deke.
Mm-hmm.
We've all met him when we went to college, some local kid who wears eyeliner,
mm-hmm.
who looks absolutely transfixingly beautiful,
mm-hmm.
and who really enjoys, in a kind of thrilling, creepy way,
mm-hmm.
being the celebrity who looks like that.
Mm-hmm.
He's a celebrity of his own invention.
Mm-hmm.
Meadow makes... She decides she's going to shoot all night long,
mm-hmm.
and she's going to keep Deke talking.
And drinking.
And yes, and he says a lot of things that ultimately he could be arrested for.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about violence, talking about the way he's beat up a middle-aged gay man who mm-hmm. was attracted to him.
Mm-hmm.
The shocks that we encounter when we get inside these characters, there are three central ones.
Mm-hmm.
There's Meadow.
Mm-hmm.
There's her best friend.
Carrie.
And Carrie would seem to be more, well, she doesn't have the economic security
Mm-mm.
that Meadow has.
Right.
And she's looking for a real job, and she wants real success, and she's not going to do experimental film.
Right.
She's learning everything she knows about the bohemian world from her friend Meadow.
Right.
But
who can afford to be bohemian, yes.
Yes. But she's going to do girls' school movies. I thought a lot about Amy Heckerling,
right.
Fast Times at Ridgemont High, and Clueless.
Which is Carrie's favorite movie when she's in high school, you know.
Yeah, she mm-hmm. wants to make movies about people she knows,
mm-hmm.
people who will grow up to be the person she might have been if she hadn't lucked out
exactly.
and been able to make films.
Yes, and I think she, as we find out when she gets her turn to talk about her origins, she grew up watching really bad things, and she wonders if you could do a good version of them, or you could do a version of them that were from, you know, that's from the women's point of view. And that was really striking. I remember seeing Fast Times at Ridgemont High when I was in high school and thinking, this is a very funny movie, but there's also some real things in there from a girl's point of view
things.
About having an abortion, about brothers and sisters. I'd never seen anything like that in a teenager movie before.
Now there's a third central character.
Mm.
Her name, she calls herself Nicole
mm-hmm.
when she's talking on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
Her private name for herself is Jelly.
Which her boyfriend gave her, her old boyfriend, Oz.
And she also was born with the name Amy.
Right.
And in many ways, as soon as I encounter a character with three different names, I say, this is a Dana Spiota character. Because
uh-oh.
It means, yes, that there are three, you know, the three faces of Eve.
Mm-hmm.
Who is Jelly?
Well, I mean, Jelly's an interesting character. I mean, I think that you touched on something that I think is very important, which is money and privilege. And I think so much of what these different women do with what they have has to do with some of their privilege. And I think when Jelly finally confronts Meadow, she says, "You are so lucky," you know, and it's almost an accusation. It is an accusation. And so I think there's something very poignant in Jelly, but I also think what's poignant about her is that she... What struck me about her, she doesn't expect a lot of the world. She doesn't have a lot of faith in Jack and realizes too late that she should have had more faith in him. Again, I'm very interested in these moments where you inadvertently, where you don't realize that you're doing something that has really dire consequences for other people. And I think Jelly doesn't understand what she's doing because she needs to do it so badly.
Yes. She's the character who has to deal with a dire truth she feels.
Mm-hmm.
She knows she's not beautiful. She knows she's middle-aged now.
Mm-hmm.
She thinks of herself as a jelly donut.
Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't have the buoyant physicality that rescues the other two women.
Yes.
She's really living in the crisis of self-esteem.
And it's interesting because that's, it's kind of touchy. I mean, Jelly, even when she has sexual fantasies, she doesn't even imagine herself in her own sexual fantasies. She is not a person who loves her own body, although she is really a person who feels through her body, even when she's on the phone.
Yeah, she's a person who self-invented during the era of phone sex, but she has an eerie ability to hear into the life of the man she's talking to. She calls famous Hollywood people.
Or quasi-famous, let's say.
Yes.
Right.
Writers of film scores,
right.
Producers, assistant directors, but she knows everything about them. And she seduces them with her knowledge. If any of them want to start getting genitally involved, she'll hang up on them. That's it.
Right.
But she wants the intimacy that can come without physicality. And I think that's become, in the age of the net,
absolutely,
a kind of constant. People writing fantasies to one another. You call them in this book fabules. And all of the characters are culpable of them. These are the ways that these people make themselves up, invent themselves, and move forward. I thought it would be nice and creepy to hear a section of Dana Spiota's Innocence and Others. And this is one of the first acts of phone seduction we hear from the woman who is known as Jelly.
If she lay on her side and let the receiver rest on her head, using only a hand for balance, she could talk for hours. "Hello," said a male voice that cleared itself as it spoke, so that the end of the word had a cough pushing through it. Then came another cough. Was it the first time he had spoken today, or had she woken him up? Roused from sleep was a special, intimate opportunity. But it carried high risk also. The woken person could sometimes start out frightened or vulnerable and then grow angry as the reality of the call's interruption hit his conscious mind. But this man just finished coughing and waited. She closed her eyes and focused on the white of ease, of calm, of joy, the pure and loving human event of calling a stranger, reaching across the land and into a life. "Hello," she said, her voice sliding easily through the L's to the waiting hopeful O. She always takes her time. Nothing makes people more impatient than rushing. "Who is this?" "It's Nicole." "Nicole? Nicole who? I think you have the wrong number." This was a crucial moment. "Is this Mark Washburn?" "No, I mean Mark, it isn't. Who is this again?" "Nicole, I'm a friend of Mark's. I thought this was his new number." "No, that's weird. I know Mark. I mean, he's a good friend of mine." "Oh my, how awkward. I'm so, so sorry I disturbed you up." She rarely used but it was an important wordish sound that introduced a powerful unconscious transaction. Used correctly, not as a habit or a rhythmic tick, it invited another to complete the sentence. An intricate conjoining, it was an opening without content, just the pull of syntax and the human need to complete. Jack Cusano. Jack Cusano, not Jack Cusano, the record producer. Oh, yeah. Jack Cusano, who composes film scores, the gorgeous work you did on those Robert DeMarco films. "That's right," he laughed. His laugh cleared out his throat a bit more. She lay back on her pillow, held the phone so it barely touched her cheek. She imagined her voice going into the transmitter, sound waves being turned into electrical pulses, up the wires to the phone lines to a switching station, turned into a microwave speeding across the country with the memory, the imprint of her exact tone, her high and low frequencies, her elegant modulations, to the switching station in Santa Monica sending electric current up the PCH, to a Malibu beach house and into Jack's receiver, undoubtedly a sleek, black cordless phone, so fast too, instantly made back into a sound wave by the tiny amplifier near his ear. All that way, all those transformations, but no distortions, a miracle of technology. The sound was as clear as speech in a room. She could, amazing, hear the ocean in the background, a gull, the sound of water pulling back from beach. She swore she could hear the sun shining through his west-facing windows.
Dana Spiota reading a Jelly chapter from Innocence and Others. Now, this is part of what you do. Communication is not in words. It's in microtones and sounds. She spent time among phone freaks, P-H-R-E-A-K-S.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them were blind. They learned to hear the sound of interconnection, of internal operators,
mm-hmm.
getting codes that led them deeply into the system.
Mm-hmm.
And for many reasons, that's where these characters want to be, deep inside the system of technologies and intimacies, which will allow them to feel that their lives are their own.
And liberated from the limits of their bodies.
Yes. You have Meadow making films that have been lost,
mm-hmm.
lost in time. Mm-hmm. There's an experimental filmmaker in, I believe, Manitoba,
mm-hmm.
named Guy Madden,
mm-hmm.
who does what he calls seances. He brings lost films back to life.
Films that we don't know what they look like, we just know some things about them, and he invents the rest.
He tries to make the movie Tati was making when Tati died and couldn't raise the money for it. He tries to make silent films,
mm-hmm.
and it's a kind of beautiful worship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this book is about those kinds of people who've made their loves, their passions, spiritual as much as they are financial.
Yeah, I mean, I love that beautiful worship. That's a very nice phrase. There is something very, I kept one of my working titles for the book, which I didn't use, was the passion of Meta Mori, in that sense of passion, but also in that kind of religious sense of passion. There's something very interesting to me about this woman who has so much passion, and that's what drives her in what she wants to create. And there is a purity to that, that extreme. And I've always been very interested in that, always been very attracted to that. And I think you pay a cost for it.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Dana Spiota about her book, Innocence and Others. We'll continue after this short break.
Santa Monica Bay's public radio station, KCRW, relies on the support of its listeners. One way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country. Put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Dana Spiota about her latest book, Innocence and Others, which is published by Scribner. The story of two female friends navigating the world as filmmakers and their encounter with another woman who uses more traditional female charms in her own way, in her own world. Now, this is very much a book about how women make do in a world that has been demonstrated by women in film to be hugely male-dominated.
Mm.
These women in this book, they are all suffering from the question of how do I reveal the secrets of my life without giving up my life? You really have written a feminist book, and your books in many ways, from the very beginning, Eat This Document, for instance, are about the politics of survival.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting to read a novelist for whom the essential nature of the art has not died away. And so although this book is very funny, and it takes the shape of the narration of Citizen Kane.
Mm-hmm.
How do we account
mm-hmm.
for these
mm-hmm.
people? It's like mm-hmm. an ongoing narration, we meet a version of Cain's wife who's forced to sing opera even though she doesn't have the voice.
Mm-hmm.
That's Jelly.
Mm-hmm.
Jelly has taken on that role. She can't meet these men.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, she has to send them pictures of her. They don't want a platonic relationship.
Mm-hmm.
They want the woman who's seen into their soul. They've dreamt of her. They want her to be embodied, not just be a fantasy.
Yes.
And that's what films do, too. They tell us the stories we need and want to hear.
And also that the actual technology of film is a kind of lie, right? You're creating the illusion of movement out of stillness, and so much of creating something is a kind of conjuring. And I guess the fabule element of it is that there's something that we need about that. There's something very important about the imagination as a way of shaping self. So there's something that's essential about that. And then there's a part of it that then becomes dangerous too. And so that was very interesting to me, that there's a point where in order to be an artist, you have to have this imaginary self. You have to kind of imagine yourself into a new place. And I think especially for the women in the book, it takes quite an act of imagination to think of yourself as an artist who's entitled to say something about the world or to make something in the world. And so there's a conjuring that has to happen.
And Meadow, in particular, who is the central character, has gotten herself to the point in the last third of the book where she's no longer interested in victims or in being a victim. She's become interested in the perpetrators and how they can be the people that they are. And so when she writes a movie about, it's a documentary, she doesn't know where it's going to go, but she too has become seductive and entered the lives of the men who caused children to be disappeared.
Mm.
She's not in this documentary blaming them.
Right.
She's just observing the lives. In certain cases, they've killed the parents and have adopted the children as their own. And the press really goes wild in the attacks on Meadow. How dare you?
They call her a handmaiden to monsters.
Yes. and she wonders whether she is.
Mm-hmm.
When she goes out looking for stories, she tells the story of a woman who might have killed her infant daughter in the course of escaping a fire. And when she hears that story, she just says, uh-uh, no.
Yeah, she just doesn't want to hear another confession.
I've gone too far. I don't want to hear if she suffocated the child with a pillow. I don't want to hear it. We're leaving, and we're leaving right now. And she has a breakdown, and she doesn't make films of any sort.
Right, right. Although I think at the end, we have that reverie, which I, you know, this kind of, She goes back to, she starts teaching film, and she goes back to her love of film, which is the opening, right? That imaginary essay, this sort of the essay about Orson Welles, and she teaches Orson Welles. And at the end, she has this reverie of a kind of abstract, sublime film, and then it sort of comes down to one person, this sort of humble image, the possibility. There's a lot in the book about the distance between what you imagine and what actually is possible. And I think, I just think that somehow Meadow's going to try again, but in a different way.
One of these women becomes very successful in the making of a kind of commercial woman's movie.
Mm-hmm.
She takes her jokes to the edge, and she has gone as far as she can go, but she is a commercial artist.
Mm-hmm.
The other two are living in a limbo constructed out of unfulfillable desire, although both of them say that they think unrequited love is boring.
That's interesting. Yes, yes. Yes, isn't the love of when you love something like books or film, is that an unrequited love? That's an interesting question. It doesn't feel an unrequited love. It doesn't feel that way, right? When you really love a movie or a novel, it feels as if it loves you back.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that the more you
the more you give, the more it gives you, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. The better you know it, the more you find out about it, the deeper your interpretation of it. A real work of art is constructed of depth upon depth upon depth.
And it's almost a collaboration between the reader and the writer. They give you something and you give something to it, and there it is, right? I mean, that's a kind of interesting... that's the way I feel when I see a great movie or read a great book. Absolutely.
Do you ever feel that you're now teaching writing mm-hmm. at Syracuse
yes.
University? It's one of the best places because you're also there with people who've been on Bookworm, Mary Carr and George Saunders,
absolutely.
Wonderful teachers.
Some wonderful teachers.
Do you see this passion that we're speaking of that you found at Crossroads, as known in this book, Wake School? Do you find passionate students? And often as not, the passionate ones are the ones that are most in need of guidance or most easily misguided.
Well, I've noticed when I'm teaching fiction, where we're reading together, the graduate students, we have these literature classes, and I teach a class on Ulysses where we just read Ulysses. We read 50 pages a week, and we fall into the book and become obsessed, and we're all in a trance for the whole semester. I've taught it 3 times now, where the students are emailing me. It seems as though we're completely submissive to the book in every way, and it's this great thing where they feel suddenly entitled to all of literature because here's this big book that everybody talks about, and now they get the joke and they see the beauty and it's theirs too. So it's this great feeling of empowerment to do something like that. And I think that gives them also permission to take real risks as writers and to realize their possibilities. So I think that passion for a work of art absolutely is the thing that can make you into an artist. I think that has to be where it's from.
Absolutely. I agree with you really powerfully and deeply. I've been talking with Dana Spiota about her new book, Innocence and Others. Thank you for joining me, Dana.
Thank you so much, Michael.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Innocence and Others at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Brian Blanchfield is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FD Weekend wherever you listen.